You know, all of those things are really skills that are not taught anywhere, especially in school, but even explicitly. And yet those are the skills that are most critical to, and I mean, it really makes or breaks a designer's career.
Welcome to the Technical Difficulties Podcast. I'm Liz Gerber, and a design professor at Northwestern.
And I'm Lauren Lin, and I'm a student who has also worked in the design industry. Each week, we speak with women leaders in design and technology.
Welcome, or welcome back, to the Technical Difficulties Podcast, where we celebrate the careers of amazing female designers and technologists. We are thrilled to welcome Irene Au. Irene is an outstanding designer. She's the mastermind behind the user experience teams at Yahoo, Google, and Udacity, and early experience at Netscape, which I'm hoping we get to hear about. Today, she's a partner at Coastla Ventures, a venture capital firm, where she spreads the wisdom on building design and user experience teams. She's also a board member at the Smithsonian's Cooper Hewitt Design Museum, a founding member of the Design Executive Council, and a juror for the Red Dot Awards. In addition to this, she's a lifelong yoga teacher and writes about the Zen magic of yoga. We can't wait to hear from Irene. Thank you for joining us today, Irene.
Thank you for having me.
So, quick warm-up question. What is your favorite way to start your morning?
Oh, I like to start with a quick meditation, and then I play New York Times games. I like connections,
okay,
strands, the mini crossword, and spelling bee.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite among those?
Oh, they all have their gifts. You know, spelling bee entertains you for a longer amount of time, but connections, I just really love seeing things come together. It's very satisfying.
Yeah. Any strategies you wish to reveal or share with our listeners? Or are they top secret?
I don't know if I've got a good one. You know, it varies day by day, but it's just, you know, that's also part of the magic.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Recently, there was a visual connections. I don't know if you saw this one, but I was so excited. It was images as opposed to words.
Oh, you'll have to send this to me. That sounds fantastic.
If I can search for it, I will. My son sent it to me and said, Mom, you're going to love this. And I did. It was good. Relatedly, what is your favorite creativity tool?
Tool. That's an interesting word. You know, I just like pen and paper, and the mind.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great. And why, may I ask, why pen, paper, and the mind?
I just feel, I mean, like if we're talking about design tools, you know, because the realm that I operate in is typically software, and like our lives are so digital, that I think the obvious way to interpret your question about creativity tool might be like some kind of online tool for supporting creativity. But I actually think that being offline actually supports creativity far more effectively. We just have such tunnel vision when we're in front of a computer. And so anything that gets us more into our bodies, and allows us to exercise our peripheral vision, you know, and just integrate the mind and body is going to be far more effective at supporting creativity than like a tool, you know?
Yeah.
So
is there any example you have to illustrate that? Anything that recently used pen and paper in your mind to solve versus a computer?
I mean, you know, with pen and paper, it could be just a sketch or just, you know, writing down like, you know, stream of consciousness kind of words. And then it's a way of metabolizing, you know, all the stuff that's like stewing inside. Being outside is a chance to exercise peripheral vision. It's a chance to look up. It's a chance to appreciate and enjoy nature. And there's always like tons of inspiration because there's so much stimulus outside. Like the world is so interesting, but really expansive because it's kind of limitless. You know, it's boundless.
Yeah. So has anybody ever pushed back and say, well, isn't the internet limitless? And aren't there a number of inspirations there?
It's true. Yes, there's a lot of input. But, you know, like when we're practicing focused attention, when we're practicing focused vision, that is putting our brain in a certain state where like that our attention is narrowing. And so that's kind of the antithesis of being creative, where you want to be more expansive. You want to try to draw connections between very disparate things. And there's a time and place for both. But I find that too often our field of focus is more narrow than it is expansive because we're either on our computers or on our phones. So I think that's the most powerful creativity tool is our attention and how we place it.
I love that. I once had a teacher who said, to stimulate your creativity, take a different way to work every day. Even if it's just a different, you know, going around a block in a different way or going up a different set of stairs, parking in a different parking lot, because you'll notice new things, was her observation.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love that. Okay. Last warm-up question, which is there any favorite book or podcast or TV or movie you've seen that's making you think about design and technology differently, and why?
Oh, there's so many things. There's so many things, but I won't pass up this opportunity to pump up this documentary for which I was an executive producer.
Congrats.
It's a documentary.
Wow.
Thank you.
So you're also a producer?
Yeah.
I mean, you do an amazing amount of things. Okay.
Well,
What is it?
This is a documentary about Brian Eno.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I have his book on my bedside table.
Wonderful.
Can you let our audience know who he is?
Yeah. Brian Eno is a very famous music producer. He is also a visual artist, and he was also part of Roxy Music, but he's probably most well known for the musical performers that he has produced, including David Bowie, Devo, U2. He also is kind of the godfather of ambient music. And I have his artwork in my house. And I've also played a lot of his music in my yoga classes. And so when the opportunity to support the creation of a documentary about him and his work and his life came up, like, the obvious answer was yes. But the director, Gary Huskwit, is a legend himself. He created these design cult favorite movies, including a documentary about Helvetica, the font. There's also the documentary called Objectified about product design. Another documentary called Roms, which is about Dieter Roms. And so I'm also a huge fan of his work. And so this, you know, blending together of Brian Eno and Gary Huskwit's passion was great, you know. And so we said, yes, my husband and I. And little did we know at the time that we agreed to be producers for this movie, that this would become the world's first generative AI movie.
Yes. And you haven't listed the name yet. Can you say
it's
that?
It's called Eno. It's called Eno.
It is just called Eno. That's why. Yeah. Okay, great.
And it will be streaming for 24 hours on January 24th for $24.
That's
I can
tomorrow.
Send you the link.
Okay.
I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but.
Sure. Yeah, send us the link. We will pose it. I had heard about this, but I did not know you were connected to it. Oh,
yeah.
Really?
So it's built on the fly every time it's shown.
Yes.
So there are like trillions of permutations for how this movie can be played. I've seen it 3 or 4 times, and it's never the same experience twice. In fact, there's some amazing footage with him collaborating with U2 that I have heard brought people to tears, and I still haven't seen this footage.
Well, so are you going to keep, do you have to just keep watching it until it comes
up?
Well,
Gary can give us a special cut.
You have inside. Okay.
Yeah, we have an inside connection. But anyway, it's a beautiful, you know, not only is Brian Eno himself such a wonderful human being, because I had the honor and privilege of meeting him this past fall.
Great.
He is a really talented person. And, you know, his life's work, the body of work is so enormous that the only way to do it justice was to kind of create the documentary in this way, where it pulls from all this archival footage. But what really spoke to me in watching the movie was how he spoke about the importance of art and what it means. And so I think it's just a lovely, lovely, wonderful movie for a wonderful person. Made by another lovely human being. And anyone who's interested in design, art, music, culture, creativity should absolutely watch this movie.
Oh, I'm we could end the podcast right there. That was, I am thrilled to know about that and that you were part, that you were connected to it. I had heard rumors, and what wonderful news. Thank you for doing that work and your role in it. Okay. Now we will get to the formal questions. Okay. That was just the warm up, Irene. So I don't know what else to talk about. But this is, we do want to talk about your career, because this is where you are today, but how did you get there? And so the question I want to start with is, how did you get started in tech and design? And in particular, was there a moment of like an, I'm a designer, I'm a technologist moment, or was it more in retrospect? How did it come? You have degrees in industrial engineering, computer and electrical engineering, and human computer interaction. Tell us a little bit about what got you to this fabulous place in your career.
Yeah. I'm the daughter of a physics professor, and my mother was a computer programmer analyst. I grew up in South Carolina. My parents were immigrants from Hong Kong. And my father kind of did not really support any kind of exploration of hobbies or the arts. Like, really, I was kind of trained to just focus on school.
Wow.
And
okay.
I grew up during, you know, in the dawn of the personal computer era. So yes, like I learned how to program in BASIC at the age of 10. I never had Barbie dolls or anything like that, but I did get like a Commodore 64. It was first a Commodore VIC-20, and then I got a Commodore 64.
Okay, Irene, I have to ask you a question. How did you learn how to code BASIC? Did you have a textbook? That's the question I want to ask.
So my father paid the brother of a friend of mine, a childhood friend of mine, to teach me.
I love it.
So that was my childhood. And I had always been very, more tilted on math and science. I liked how there was a definitive answer to things. There's a right and a wrong. When I look back at how I like to spend my time just as a child, like what kinds of things do I engage in? You know, like I used to be fascinated by junk mail, like those Valpak coupons.
Oh, I did too. No, tell me what you fascinated you.
Just like so interested in like the language, the marketing, the design. I didn't know that there was such a thing called graphic design, that there would even be a field that you could study. But I was just fascinated, and I would kind of try to reverse engineer it by creating my own fake junk mail. So when I was a kid, I used to create my own fake junk mail. I created a library of all of my books. I forced my brother to check out books from my library. I loved like the task of organizing my books. And so later when I went on to Google, I was like, oh my God, this is exactly tied to my amateur library science background as a child. And then the other thing I liked to do was to draw interior elevations. Like I was an amateur interior designer. And so it was just, but I chose to study electrical and computer engineering because I was a math science kid in high school. I was president of the math club and, you know, things like that. And my boyfriend at the time said that he was going to study electrical and computer engineering. And so I was like, well, if he can do it, then I can do it. So that's how I fell into that. And, I had a Mac SE in 1984-85. So like that
blew my mind. Can you just describe what that looked like? Like what was the volume? What were the proportions of that?
You know,
just for our
like
listeners. Like a foot. It was like a foot tall, maybe a foot and a half.
Yeah,
but the screen was...
It was tiny.
At max,
yeah, maybe
right?
6 or 7 or 8 or 9 inches. My dad, I think, still has it and uses it as a doorstop.
Yeah.
that really blew my mind too, because it was like this visual representation of what I had imagined in my mind when I learned how to navigate file systems and things like that. Like, oh, folders and files. And it like the display was like so obvious. But there was nothing else like it. So that was really cool. And then eventually I learned how to log in with my 1200 baud modem onto bulletin boards, and I would have my own email account and things like that. And this was like 1987. I mean, I was like a real nerd.
And then the modem, just to be clear, was it still the handheld like rotary phone that you stuck into the
modem
box?
I mean, it's like it was connected through the jack.
It was jack. Yeah. By then it was jack. Okay.
But so I was, you know, that's like early childhood. I mean, it wasn't even the internet at that time, but there were bulletin boards. So in college, I built robots and I learned about chip design and things like that, like logic gates and all that was really fun. And without a clear vision for what I wanted to do with my life, I decided to pursue a PhD in electrical engineering. At the time, I thought I was going to work on chip design, like VLSI design.
Sure,
which is
sure.
really funny because that ex-boyfriend of mine, he is actually a chip designer at Apple now and
oh,
lives
no
in Los
way.
Altos. Yeah, it's so funny. But what I discovered at the University of Illinois when I was there was I was the only girl out of hundreds and hundreds of students. I mean, definitely the only girl
you.
In the graduate program. And
yeah.
I was just looking around feeling like I am not like these people. Like they're just interested in building stuff for the sake of building stuff. Like they just love technology so much. But I found that I was like, you know, how can technology support people? And then how do people influence the creation of technology? And then one day I was studying in the student union and this acquaintance of mine approached me and asked if he could study with me. And so he sits down and he pulls out this textbook and it's called Engineering Psychology and Human Factors by Chris Wicken.
Oh,
and,
yes.
Oh, my gosh. So I was like, wow, what a cool title. Can I flip through this book? You know, and I'm looking through the pages like, oh, my God, this is so amazing. I had never in my dreams imagined that there was like a whole field of study around this, you know, understanding using the principles of human cognition, perception, memory, attention, you know, and how do you apply that towards the design of machines? And a lot of the professors, and not a lot, but there was like, you know, some prominent professors who were looking at human factors as it applied to the design of airplane cockpits. So like, how
yes.
do you avoid pilot error? And so I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do. And coincidentally, and it's so funny how like, you know, things kind of converge in your life at the right time, at the right moment. And I remember in sitting in my computer architecture class one day, flipping through my textbook, this was written by John Hennessy, who later became the president of Stanford.
Correct.
But I found myself bored in class. I was flipping through the textbook and I found this graph from IBM Human Factors Research that like illustrated Fitts' law or something. And I was
yes.
like, wow, like, this is another aha moment. And it happened all around the same time. And so I researched like, who are all the professors at the University of Illinois who are, you know, tangentially interested in this space? And I wrote to every single one of them and one of them wrote me back and she was looking for someone to join her lab as a graduate student who could code and develop software. She was a professor of cognitive engineering and she was looking at a variety of things, but among them were like human factors in emergency rooms and operating rooms, as well as like the, you know, how do you apply human factors towards the design of software. And I knew how to code. So I had something to offer her and she taught me everything she knew. And so that's how I kind of pivoted. And I, you know, this is before you could study human centered design or human computer interaction, but I created my own program of study drawing from classes in the departments of psychology, computer science, and industrial engineering. So that was kind of my transition over there. And then this was in the mid 90s. And at the University of Illinois, we had NCSA, which is, you know, the research institution where Mosaic was created. So the University of Illinois was literally the birthplace of the first graphical web browser. And so this kind of permeated the whole culture at the university. Like we were probably the first university to have our course catalog online and, you know, things like that. And so as an early adopter, you could really start to see how is this going to change the way we do things? And then also like, oh my gosh, the design of these websites are so bad. How do you apply HCI principles and practices towards the design of websites? And so I was a very early person doing that. And so my then fiance and I, as we started to look at job opportunities, we had considered offers from a variety of places, but we knew in our hearts that the number one place we wanted to be in was Silicon Valley, and we wanted to work at Netscape. And so it happened, and that was kind of how I launched my career.
And that was an amazing story. And they say that, you know, you have to be in the right place, but you also have to be prepared. And I think you were very prepared to take advantage of those opportunities. For our listeners who might not know what Netscape is, would you mind just sharing what Netscape is and just how exciting it was to work at Netscape at the time? And maybe in 1 minute, you know, what Netscape led to and what we think of what we,
right. So,
what services we may think of today.
Yeah, Netscape was the first commercial web browser. So whereas Mosaic was the academic kind of researchy kind of product, all these guys like Mark Andreessen and a bunch of other people from the University of Illinois decided to form a company. And it was really the first internet startup darling that kind of really kicked off the whole frenzy around internet startups.
And established so many interesting principles and practices. And then you went on and you worked at Yahoo and Google. So you've really worked at the powerhouse.
Well, what's funny is that, you know, at the time that Netscape made me an offer, they were still a startup, but I still had one semester left in school. So I said, no, I need to finish school to get my degree. And I joined in like June of, 1996. And they had gone public like in May or something. So I missed the IPO. But nevertheless, around the time I joined is when Microsoft started integrating Internet Explorer into the operating system. And that led to, a precipitous decline. And that Microsoft's anti-competitive practices were not the only reason why Netscape didn't survive. But I won't get into that. But long story short, like I started to realize that the interesting design challenges for the internet was not so much in the viewfinder through which we see the content, but in the design of the content and the experiences within that viewfinder itself. So whereas I was a designer for the browser, the mail news client, the page editor, I was increasingly tilting my interest towards the design of the content. And that was Netscape was not really the place for that because they were so focused on the browser technology and the server technology that the people working on the content side of things, the NetCenter portal, was just like not really a priority. And then at some point, Netscape decided to open source the browser code. And I realized there's no place for a designer in the open source community because that's like one designer corralling, like a bajillion people working on the code, like an engineer's, like your ratio. So I was just not mature enough in my career to want to handle anything like that. Interestingly, Yahoo, which at the time was really just a directory of websites. It was a hand-curated directory of websites. Right. At the time, they had 500 employees. They just bought Rocket Mail, which eventually became Yahoo Mail. They had just launched My Yahoo, which was the first personalized homepage. They could see a direction where they were going to start developing web services. They wanted someone with my background and experience to help them methodically build experiences that were usable, useful, desirable. I thought about a variety of different companies to join. But ultimately, I picked Yahoo because I loved the hiring manager and I loved the energy at that company. Like there was just this, everybody's stressed out and busy for sure, but it was a good kind of stressed out and busy. There's like a happy energy that I found there that I didn't find anywhere else. And in fact, that very boss who hired me is still one of my closest friends. I talk to him almost every day. And even the team that I eventually built and hired, like, we're still like a family. Like I just had them, we had a reunion at my house with about 100 people this past summer. So it was a really special time that, I've never really seen anywhere else that I've worked. And I just feel so grateful and privileged to have been a part of that. It was really, we were the first and one of the few internet companies that really had a human-centered design practice. And so to be able to create a vision for what that might look like and how we would operate and what kind of people to bring on, because it wasn't like there were a lot of people who were studying, like majoring in this. So it's like, how do you find the people with the right raw materials who are going to like figure it out? So that was just really an amazing journey. And then, I think the 8 years that I was at Yahoo was really like being at three different companies because there was the internet boom time, then the bust in the early 2000s, and then the rebirth in the Web 2.0, era. And by that time, they had kind of lost their way. They had lost their vision. There wasn't a strong technical infrastructure that would allow the company to operate efficiently. And there's been a lot out there on the internet that has written about it. But all that is like 20 years old now, so we won't talk about that. But at the same time, like Google was kind of on the rise, and I was so intrigued by Google. This was around 2006, And my then husband at the time, who's now my ex-husband, he joined Google about 6 months before I did. And he would come home talking about the amazing food and how interesting it was. And, you know, meanwhile at Yahoo, everybody's like, oh my gosh, yeah, you know, Google this, Google that. What's Google going to do? What's Google doing?
Yeah.
So like when the opportunity came to run the design team at Google, which was still fledgling and, you know, kind of an upstart in and of itself, I really was so curious. I just you know, wanted to go there. And you know, what's funny is that a lot of my colleagues were like, oh my God, you took that job? Because this was not perceived to be a job that anybody wanted. Similar to Yahoo, actually, in 1998, Google in 2006 was not perceived to be like an obvious place for designers to go. Mm-hmm. Both of them were very deliberately undesigned. In the way that most designers think of design, like it was deliberately without adornment, and it was very text-based and it was nerdy and, you know, but
which is a design aesthetic, to your point.
Exactly.
I mean, there's many ways of designing design, design interactions.
I mean, what I saw was intention and a lot of integrity towards that intention, which is that all four founders, the two founders at Yahoo and the two founders at Google, all had a similar insight and intention, which was that the best experience and the most usable experience was the fastest one.
Mm-hmm.
And so every design decision was informed by this idea of speed and fast. But in any case, when I joined Google in 2006, there were 60 designers, most of whom were new college graduates. And there were about 40 usability analysts. And so the whole way that they interfaced with like, the development teams for different products, was still emerging because at that time, 99% of the traffic coming to Google was for Google search. And yet we were starting to develop Google, you know, like Gmail. We had just bought Writely, which became Google Docs. And then shortly after I joined, we bought DoubleClick, we bought YouTube. And so there was a lot of opportunity to better structure how we did our work, how we engaged with product management and engineering, the ways in which user research could be valued, because they were really doing kind of design QA with usability studies, and there was so much opportunity to do more in terms of informing, you know, what should be built and how it should be designed. And so that was really a huge transformation that I was responsible for.
And I would say that, and I just want to, another highlight that I think I was admiring from the outside was really this this A/B testing, this idea of like, let's ask users what they think, you know, should we do it this way or that way, but less asking, but just showing and seeing what gets more clicks or what's more efficient. And that was lauded from the outside. I don't know what it felt like to be running the inside.
That's the double-edged sword too, because I've seen it at high levels of dysfunction as well. And I think, you know, one of the problems is there's a time and place for A/B testing, but it's not a substitute for really like designing a holistic, intentional, you know, experience. And the reason why there was so much A/B testing at Google is because the search results page is actually a very sensitive interface. Like slight changes to the font size, the font choice, whether you bullet item the search results, whether you underline the links, the leading, you know, and spacing between the lines and things like that.
Exactly.
Any of those little details can radically impact the key metrics that Google cared about.
Right.
And ultimately that means like whether people click on ads. Okay, let's just face it. So that's really what all that A/B testing was about.
Right. Well, as a design student at the time at Stanford, early 2000s, that was just mind-blowing to all of us that you had the data to speak to that. So that was exciting. I feel like I could talk to you all day. I mean, I'm learning so much and there's so many points of connection and there's so many threads to pull on, but I want to pull on two. The first one is around there seems to be a history of you going into places before design is recognized or accepted or fully embraced. And so I want to bring us up to the current position you have, which is at a venture capital firm. And quite honestly, from the outside, again, everybody said, wow, Irene's going in and bringing in design into venture capital. If anybody can do it, it's her. But it wasn't really there before, I will say. So I'm going to credit you with really introducing and popularizing design within venture capital. And I'm wondering if you can speak to that experience.
Yeah. Well, first, I'll just rewind and talk a little bit about how I work with our portfolio. So like in venture capital, you have investing partners, and they're the ones responsible for deal flow, due diligence, making investment decisions, sitting on the boards, you know, that sort of thing. Sure. And then we have a team of operating partners who have deep functional experience, like hands-on experience, you know, helping, like working within an operating role and inside companies that have kind of been through the journey that many startups hope to be on. And the existence of operating partners within venture capital firms is also not a given thing. It really only exists within maybe the largest VC firms that can afford it. And I think is also something that comes in and out of vogue depending on the state of venture capital. So like during the boom times when VC firms are kind of competing with each other for hot deals with entrepreneurs, having operating partners is a way for the VC firms to differentiate themselves through these services to help the founders be successful. And then, you know, kind of in bust times, you might see operating partner roles go away because there's just there's not as much competition for the deals anyway. So I'll just, you know, with that background, you know,
leave it at that.
And at Coastal Ventures, we have this slogan, kind of venture capital, venture assistance. So the idea is that we do more than just throw money at the entrepreneurs. We have a team of people who are really, our goal is to help the CEOs be successful, whatever that means. And we invest in hard tech. So the portfolio is largely super nerdy companies. I mean, these are like founded by amazing technologists and scientists in like AI, robotics, food sciences, energy, you know, things like that. And so they are amazing technologists, but they don't know, most of them don't know anything about design. And
yes.
Or
they think it's like curtains. And they think it's like picking curtain colors. If they do think they know something. Yeah.
And you know, what's interesting is that I think around like around the time that I joined Coastal Ventures, and I've been there for almost 11 years now, like around the time that I joined, I think there was like a rise in understanding that design is important to a company's success. But there was a lot of naivete around like, well, how do you know a good designer when you see one? How do you find them? How do you structure them within a company so they're successful? How do you set them up for success? And where do you find these people? You know, all these kinds of questions. And then because the job market was so hot for designers, like, you know, a lot of times a small startup can't afford to hire like a senior designer. Like they don't want to, these, you know, people who are more senior, like they have mortgages, they have children, they don't necessarily want to join a small startup. But, you know, you can't just hire junior people either because, you know, in a startup, like everybody else has power except for the designer. You know, the engineers are the ones writing the code. If there's a product manager, you know, usually the product manager is the CEO, but if there's the product manager, like they're considered the CEO of the product. And the designer does usually, especially the junior designers, they don't necessarily have the experience or the gravitas to be able to hold power to advocate for successful design. So then it's like a blind leading the blind. So I also, in addition to coaching CEOs, I find myself coaching and mentoring a lot of the designers inside startups because they're like the only one, you know, and they're still growing in their careers, they're still learning and, you know, that sort of thing. So, anyway, that's one of the ways. Those are some of the ways in which I get involved. I mean, really, it just comes down to how can I help? What's keeping the CEO up at night and how can I help?
Thank you. The other string I want to pull on is your interest in and maybe supporting fastest being one of the metrics of success. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I'd love to hear your reflections on the proliferation of AI and the way in which that makes some things faster, but maybe without attention to unintended consequences or potentially de-skilling some some people, some creatives. I'd love to just, I'm opening it way up to say, what is the future of AI and design? And what's our criteria for success? What do you think it should be?
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a very broad and deep question.
I know, and I did not prepare you for that. My next question was supposed to be, what's the most surprising thing you learned in your journey so far? So if you want to take that question, Seth, that's fine.
No, I'd love to answer all these questions. when we talk about AI and design, that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. So, you know, one vector is to think about, like, how are designers going to be impacted by AI?
Yeah.
And certainly, and I've already seen this, you know, the development of tools that will allow, it will basically democratize design. It will allow anybody to be able to create graphic design assets for a marketing campaign. It will allow anybody to create any kind of illustration they need. But beyond that, it will allow anybody to be able to create an interface, and even experiences on top of various modular technical components. You know, we already had that with AWS and, you know, things like that that have really already kind of made it a lot easier for companies to create, for entrepreneurs to create an app or a company with very little capital, because
that's right.
You know, so this is just like a continuation of that trend.
Correct.
It happened first with technology. Now it's happening at the front end. And so, like, hopefully that will mean that we start to see better design in the world, because maybe there will be better templates for people, stronger design patterns that will create more consistency across the board. But, you know, it can be threatening for designers for sure. But it reminds me a lot of when I was at Google and I was trying to create a common look and feel for Google. And a lot of the designers at that time felt very threatened by this push towards standardization, because they felt like it was going to take away their creativity. And my answer to that was that, look, it's just going to force us to be better. It's going to push our efforts upstream so that we can provide more strategic value to Google.
Yeah.
And that has definitely played out. And I think that's, it's going to change the nature of our profession as designers. AI will, for sure.
Yeah.
One of my pet peeves is when designers kind of moan and groan about, like, oh, we don't get a seat at the table, you know, and things like that. But, really, design is about making vision tangible. And that's the superpower that we have that nobody else has. And if you can use those skills to help stakeholders understand the consequences of their decisions, then hopefully that leads to more informed decision making. And so that kind of leads into your question about unintended consequences and things like that. It's like, sometimes, you know, like I found this many times over, but especially at Udacity, where we would talk about stuff and it all, you know, we all thought that we were all talking about the same thing, but it was only until we, like, actually drew it out that it was like you could get into the specifics and say, oh, you know, no, I was thinking this. No, I was thinking that, you know, and then you can sort out those details. And it's only because people get this visceral response when things are brought to life. You get to really feel what it's like to be, you know, you feel it in your body, like what it's like to, for, you know, A versus B. So, you know, that's really where designers can play a really instrumental role. It's not necessarily in the icons or the layout or, you know, all those things are important too. Like, for sure, beauty is super important. And I actually regret that as a design community, we don't talk enough about the importance of beauty. We, you know, in our efforts to, you know, be more strategic, we talk about design thinking and, you know, like the you know, strategic, but like, beauty is strategic as well, and also provides, like, immense value to the human experience. So anyway, that's kind of a ramble. I don't know if I really answered the question.
No, you did. You answered it. So many things to follow up on. But again, wanting to be respectful of time and wanting to know that I feel like you are a design philosopher, and I want to ask you many more questions about your philosophy of design. What it does bring me to, and your connection, obviously, now you are on the board of the premier design museum of the United States, and I'm sure discussing what the future of design, future, past, history, you know, of design is, and would love to talk more about that. But I'm going to wrap up by asking you about your three questions. I'll ask them. You can answer them in order if you like, which is, what is a surprising thing you learned in your career so far that might not, some advice you might want to give to our listeners? And then what's something you still want to do? I know you've done it all, but I sense you are the kind of person, you probably have a list of 100 more things you're set to do. So I'd love to hear an unexpected piece of advice and something that you still want to do in your life. That's important.
Well, a couple of things. I don't know if this is one of your questions. The surprising thing that I've learned on my journey so far, and I think this is especially important for your audience. Like, great. I don't know if there's enough understanding or emphasis placed on the importance of soft skills and emotional intelligence as a key critical component for designer success. And, you know, design in comparison is easy. Like drawing the stuff, brainstorming, coming up with ideas. Really, that's the easy part of the job, relatively speaking. The hard part is that, like, look, everybody's got an opinion about design. You know, everybody's prioritizing something. You know, design is all about having a point of view, and everybody's going to be optimizing for something else. And then when you add in like an organization, like a big company with like people with different agendas and politics and stuff like that, design, it becomes really hard to execute well because of the people factor. And the only way to bust through that is with like high skills and emotional intelligence, the ability to listen, to make people feel heard, to bring ideas to life, to make vision tangible, to negotiate. You know, all of those things are really skills that are not taught anywhere, especially in school, but even explicitly. And yet those are the skills that are most critical to, and I mean, it really makes or breaks a designer's career, whether they get promoted, whether they can become executives, whether they're respected by designers that report to them, and also the peers and their stakeholders within the organization. So that's something I just really want to emphasize to your audience.
I love that. And let me just follow up that I got greatest design training, et cetera, but then decided I need to do a PhD in organizational behavior precisely because of the reason you said. It's like, wait a minute, the people. Not that doing a PhD helps you understand, helps you be a better soft skill person with soft skills, but just as a focus of study, I thought, oh, wait a minute. The organization and how people work together, that's what really influences whether a brilliant idea gets out in the world or not. It's got to go through this organization. So,
well, I often think like growing up as a petite Asian female in South Carolina really trained me to next level kind of skills in terms of being like a woman designer in tech.
Oh, interesting.
All the same skills that you have to cultivate, you know, like listening to others, seeing another perspective, you know, and embracing that and not judging, but then also like assimilating and then presenting alternate points of views in ways that are not threatening to other people. And how do you make things, you know, how do you make people feel like it's coming from them and that it's their idea, you know, that's coming from this egoless place? Because it's really like, you know, I was coming from a position that like where there's no power or authority or control. And yet design really, like excellent design really requires all of that. So how do you do this in a context where you don't have any of that, you know, but still want to see the same outcome? So it really is like kind of selfless ego leadership.
I love that. Brilliant.
And then in terms of unexpected advice, like the other thing I will say, and this is an observation I've made after looking at countless resumes and portfolios, is that there was a period of time where people would job hop, you know, every 12 to 18 months because the job market was so hot and you could just like go to another role, get more pay, get a higher job title. And now I see a glut of designers who have amazing job titles at X, Y, and Z companies, and, you know, but they've never really accomplished anything because there's only so much you can do in 12 to 16, 18 months in a single place. So I, you know, like, kind of don't quit, commit, you know, like you want to be someplace long enough where you can really have an impact and really be challenged and grow. You know, and at the same time, like, you know, you know, I have one of my best friends was at a company who, you know, is an enterprise company. She was there for like 20 years and kind of missed the opportunity to challenge herself in a different context. So there's a balance, but I would say that the career trajectories that I've seen of the younger generation over the past 10 years has really been to their detriment.
Interesting.
So, okay. Yeah,
that's super helpful. And anything you still want to learn and do?
Oh, you know, it's a little bit difficult to talk about this because it's so esoteric. But I mean, I guess one way to sum it up would be, you know, like if I were to describe all of this under a single rubric, it would really be under the practicing the art of attention.
Ooh, okay.
And this kind of is an umbrella that that kind of extends into mind, body, spirit. So like in terms of the body, it's like, how am I moving my body? And this is like really nerding out on physical therapy, like body mechanics. Like I had some muscle imbalances that led to misalignment of my musculoskeletal structure. And then I also like didn't have a neural connection to some of the muscles in my body. So some muscles weren't even firing. Wow. And so wow. I just had to reverse engineer all that and then rehabilitate myself. So I actively saved myself from needing foot and hip and knee surgery, which is great. It's amazing. But also related to the body is like, how do I sleep? How do I feed myself? My younger daughter suffered from a complex chronic illness for the last 6 years. And so that set me off on a whole journey, learning as much as I could about functional medicine, holistic health practices, and also down this other road of, you know, and just navigating like my own journey around menopause led me to look into naturopathic medicine, traditional Chinese medicine. And so that's like the body. And then in terms of the mind and the spirit, also looking at like, so how do I move? How do I feed myself? How do I sleep? But then how do I love? How do I show up in this world? How do I cultivate love for people who like challenge me the most? And in this time of like extreme political division where even everything is politicized, it's like, how do we make the space for understanding people whose views are very different from ours and to love them the same? And that actually takes a lot of work. There's no like quick hack for that. But what I've discovered in that journey is that in doing so, also like my whole being has changed, like my spirit and how I relate to the world. And I spent a lot of time in New Zealand over the last couple of years. Wow. And just being immersed in that much nature in such a concentrated time where I didn't know anybody and there was nobody to interact with except my husband. You know, you're really with yourself and you get to know yourself a lot. And then suddenly just the way I experience the world is just very different. Like as I've gone on this journey with naturopathic medicine and subtle body energies and things like that, like I've started to veer into this realm of bioenergetics and energy medicine and elevated states of consciousness and what kind of powers that can give you and things like that. And it's very esoteric and very difficult to talk about publicly, but it's something I'm really excited to learn more about and to experience because now I've gotten a taste of it and I can see, I can see and measure what I felt before, but couldn't measure. I can actually do that now. And so it's just, it's amazing. So anyway, that's a whole nother conversation we don't have time
but that
for.
It sounds so powerful. It's, and something I want to conclude with is I so deeply honor and admire your attitude towards learning and living with intention. It comes through in everything you've said. And I love that we started off with you learning basic programming, and now we're talking about the tensions of the body and the breath and the curiosity you have for living is inspirational. So thank you. Thank you so much, Irene. I really do feel like I could talk to you for hours and hours. And the next time I'm out there, if you're up for it, I'd love to take you to coffee and thank you.
Yes, I would
personally
love that.
I feel like there's endless things we could have talked about. Is there anything you wanted to say before we round out that you didn't get to say that you were thinking and planning to share?
Oh, I mean, there's so many things, but I always love hearing some people and happy to connect with anyone. So, you know, people can reach out to me on LinkedIn if they want to chat with me more.
That was Irene Au. And you can find out more about her in the show notes. You can learn more about this show by going to technicaldifficultiespodcast.com. Drop us a note at technicaldifficultiesteam@gmail.com or leave us a review on your favorite podcast app.